Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things that everybody's passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics.
What is real? Who is well off? Who's a truly good person? And how does one become a truly good person? Our guest today, Dallas Willard, has written a book that makes a very bold claim. We need not settle for mere opinions or even one man's perspective on the answers to these questions. We can have knowledge of the answers, knowledge that could be taught in a research university alongside science and history courses, knowledge that could be published in peer-reviewed journals. Dr. Dallas Willard, a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern California, has written a book full of scholarly yet very understandable and accessible reasons for why we can trust spiritual knowledge.
Dallas Willard, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Dallas, one way to answer these questions, the who is well off, who's truly a good person, and how do we become that, is to take a handful of highly qualified young people, the best and the brightest, poised for successful lives, and then study the trajectory of their lives over their entire lifetimes, and then scientifically analyze what those lives tell us about who is well off and what it takes to get there, and how one becomes a successful person. And as you may be familiar with, this approach has been tried, and the finding reported in this month's Atlantic Monthly magazine and summarized in a New York Times op-ed piece by David Brooks. It was called The Grant Study. And Brooks describes this group of 268 promising young men, including JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who entered Harvard College. And by any normal measure, they had it made. They tended to be bright and polished and affluent and ambitious. And they had the benefit of the world's most prestigious university. And even among Harvard students, they were selected as the most well-adjusted. And then the team assembled to study them spanned medicine, physiology, anthropology, psychiatry, psychology, and social work, every scientific expertise available to the project. And yet, a third of these men would suffer at least one bout of mental illness. Alcoholism would be a running plague. The most mundane personalities often produced the most solid successes. And the study offers one scientifically quantifiable conclusion, that relationships bring happiness. But aside from that, Brooks concludes, it's the baffling variety of their lives that strikes me the most. There's a complexity to human affairs before which science and analysis simply stands mute. In other words, what I take from this is that science can't offer us much by way of knowledge or answers to these questions. Would you agree?
Well, it doesn't even attempt to answer those questions. And the problem that the best and the brightest, or the ones who have it made, run into is they don't ask those questions, and they don't try to answer them intelligently. They think they have the answers, and they launch forth in life with a sort of grab bag of opinions that they have picked up and never thought about. And those are the questions you ask. The problem is today partly seen in education does not address those questions for the people who are in the mix. But it's been true for a long time, and this study back from the 30s and 40s and on is just a brilliant illustration of what goes wrong. Like their conclusion that relationships are what matter. But what kind of relationships? See, they don't deal with that. It is true that the human well-being is located in relationships. But, of course, all of those people had relationships. The alcoholics had relationships. The ones with mental breakdowns. So the problem is to address intelligently what kind of relationships and how do you live in those relationships. And this is what is not asked. And people just make assumptions, launch their life into the distance on the assumptions, and hit the wall.
Dallas, and we're talking with Dallas Willard, professor of philosophy at USC, and so you speak from inside the university. If these questions are so central to human flourishing, why aren't they taught in our universities? Why aren't our students required to take at least one course of study built around researching the answers to these questions?
Very simply, the university for decades has been in the process of divorcing itself and distancing itself from the Christian church. In the periods when the church dominated the university, which was well up into the 20th century, they did address those questions. They addressed them officially. They gave answers to them. Now, of course, you know, no one's infallible and one can criticize the answers, but at least they tried. Now no one answers them. There is not, in any university, a department of reality or a department of the good life.
Or a department of course. Or just one required course.
Well, who's going to teach it?
Yeah.
The problem is that in the process of development into professions, the academic fields have divorced themselves from these questions. And in large measure, it is a part of the process of secularization, of distancing the universities from the church. See, Harvard, for example, for most of its history, was a profoundly Christian school. And indeed, well up into the, at least the end of the 19th century, and that's what it stood for. And that's how it got its money. And all of that stuff that goes into supporting a huge educational operation now. And, you know, the university still has a moral tone because education is a moral project, but no one is dealing seriously with the questions. And so we bring in our bright young people and have them sit around in classes and go through the events of student life, which are, in many cases, is where they learn most of what they learn for life, which is a disaster. And then we send them out into the world, and they are not equipped to deal with those questions, and their lives fall apart. It's very interesting, you know, that in the study, and this, by the way, is not new, but in the study, as David Brooks reports it, it turns out that some people who were not so bright turned out better than the ones who were.
Yes.
And frankly, I've watched that for years, and the difference is the ones who are so bright or who think they are less thoughtful about what really matters than the people who sort of have to say to themselves, now, you know, I'm not so smart. I've got to be careful.
Yeah. I remember reading Bobos in Paradise, I think it was, where David Brooks went and literally interviewed university administrators and professors on why don't you teach something about these questions in your universities? Why don't you teach character or,
right,
you know, what it means to be good? And I remember that, I think it was the dean of Princeton, it was one of the faculty at Princeton responding, we just let the students steer themselves.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And yet, Dallas, you claim that we can have knowledge of answers to these questions of who is well off, who's a truly good person, how does one become a truly good person? What do you mean by that?
Well, you first have to understand what knowledge is, and knowledge is the capacity to represent something, let's say being well off, as it really is on an appropriate basis of thought and experience. Now, the problem is that we don't devote the thought and the experience to these, and consequently we have no, people generally have no knowledge. I don't mean to say no one does, because there are people who do. But in general, and among Christians and non-Christians alike, what happens is thoughtlessness prevails. And we don't have knowledge because we are not thoughtful. Knowledge does not jump down your throat. Even knowledge of the multiplication tables is not something that just jumps on you.
Sometimes mom will jump down your throat if you don't learn the math, but the knowledge won't.
Mom is one of the greatest assets that we have in life.
Fountain of wisdom and knowledge. Mm-hmm. Go, moms. Yeah.
Yes, and you know, that's really simply because they know how important it is. And they don't want to raise people and send them out into the world unequipped to deal with the realities that are there. And so moms, and they used to be dads and uncles and aunts and grandpas and grandmas, were on the job. Now they're not on the job. They've been disqualified because now education from elementary school up tells them They don't know what they're talking about because they're not educators.
And so, okay, we have this one grant study, this big Harvard-sponsored study, and it identified these major factors that predict healthy aging, both physically and psychologically, the things that really matter most, to take a page from the title of our show, the things that matter most in life. And they come up with these quantifiable answers. Relationships are most important in life, relationships with other people. Employing mature adaptations to stress and disruption was another factor.
Right.
And then the other factors were education, stable marriage, not smoking, not abusing alcohol, some exercise, and healthy weight. Would you recommend that, you know, why wouldn't universities offer at least a course of study in those things?
Because of exactly what the Princeton guy said to David Brooks. They don't want to interfere with the freedom of the student. They want to say to the student, now you just make your choices and don't hurt anybody and be diverse, but beyond that, just whatever you choose. And of course, no one would send a kid into a chemistry lab and say, now just mix up anything you want. And do anything you wish, because the explosions would be so imminent and the bad smells. But frankly, that's what this study does, is it says, in effect, look, the explosions and the bad smells are all over the place, and they ruin people's lives. And among other things, they also spend time with people who are failures, making them look good because of some outward sign of success.
Now, Dallas, I know from reading your book that you believe and put forth your argument that religious and spiritual and moral truths can be known in the same way that math or science can be known. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, they can be known in the same degree.
Okay,
that's a good clarification.
I wouldn't say in the same way, because the thing is, now, when you talk about knowledge, you have to recognize that every subject matter dictates its own method. Right? Suppose you would like to have a wonderful backyard full of flowers and just beautiful things and so on. Now, if you are willing to learn how to do that, you can do that. There is a method. And it involves talking to people, experimentation, thought, and all kinds of things of that sort. That's the method. Now, that isn't the method of mathematics. Mathematics has a different method. But every field of subject matter has its own method whereby knowledge can be achieved. That is true of the spiritual life. For example, suppose someone wanted to know the spiritual life. What would be the first thing you did? Well, probably you'd better find some people who lived it and study them. So, I mean, history is full of these people, and of all degrees and all kinds. Just start with Socrates. Now, Socrates is sort of, though he was not secular by any means, he's kind of secular saint. But no one does what he says. And then, of course, you might think about Jesus, because he's on the scene, too, and whatever you may think of the outcome in terms of the Christian church and so on, you better find out from him. And, well, look at the Buddha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't just say, well, I'm going to become informed about the Buddha. Try doing what he did. So the first step is you find people who live it and you learn from them. Then you lay out a plan of life. So what is solitude and silence about? You learn by experience, by reading, by thinking. That's the way you become a proficient brain surgeon, or politician, is you study the area with a view to amassing evidence and arriving at the truth. You lay aside your biases.
Right.
You lay aside your prejudices, and at least you keep them out of your reasoning, and you let your reasoning be governed by logic and good method, and by a will to know the truth no matter what it is, and you will find it.
Well, I think that's a good time for a break.
Yeah.
We're speaking to Dr. Dallas Willard, among many other Sorry that I don't
yes,
know that. Okay.
Just launched.
Author of this of a new book, Knowing Christ Today, subtitle, Why We Can Trust Spiritual Knowledge. And we've talked a bit here about knowledge and how one could know about the spiritual life. But I think that's a good introduction perhaps to talk about faith and how faith relates to knowledge. So I think that we'll do that when we come back. So this is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, and we'll be back in a minute. Today's graduates face college campuses and a culture that challenge their confidence in the trustworthiness of Jesus and a Christian worldview. In A Faith and Cultural Devotional, Daily Readings in Art, Science, and Life, over 70 Christian thought leaders, scientists, and artists like Dallas Willard, John Eldridge, Lee Strobel, Randy Alcorn, and Francis Schaeffer explore significant ideas, events, and people from a Christian worldview.
And together with Kelly Monroe Kullberg, author of Finding God at Harvard, we challenge students to go deeper with Christ and gain confidence in his knowledge of how the world works and how to live with joy and peace. This book is offered in 2 to 3 page readings that fit busy young lives. A Faith and Culture Devotional covers 7 subject areas, one for each day of the week. Students will enjoy reading about science with human genome director Francis Collins, art with painter Makoto Fujimura, and contemporary culture with filmmaker Jody Hassett Sanchez. Here's what one high school junior says about the book. This book took me by surprise. Not once have I found a devotional so full of fascinating information that I find myself telling my friends about it right after I read it. I love that it has truth, real truth, but in bite-sized chunks. With my school schedule, I never have time for heavy theology books to just pick up in my spare time, but this book gives me answers to questions that I frequently hear and can now confidently know how to answer without having to be a studied expert on the subject. Big fan. Faith and Culture Devotional is available in local bookstores or at Amazon.com.
Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
We're interviewing Dallas Willard, author of Knowing Christ Today, Why We Can Trust Spiritual Knowledge. We were just laughing on the break. Our producer was saying, it's like how we can know anything. You know, the big word, the big SAT word, epistemology. How can we know things for dummies?
For dummies. Okay.
Well, that's yeah,
okay.
Good.
Lael was looking at me when she said that. So.
No.
Okay. Well, Dallas, before the break, we were talking about how one would know spiritual truth. And what you described was a pretty rational process. Well, let's talk about faith. You write and see where that fits in. You write quite a bit about the idea of faith and what it is and what it's not and how many of us have come to misunderstand it. And you say that properly understood, it's not a blind leap. It's not opposed to evidence or knowledge. It's not a heroic struggle. I'm quoting you there. I like that little phrase. Mm-hmm. Because we do sort of make it sound heroic.
Yeah.
It is not a heroic struggle to believe things that really don't make much sense. And you write that the ideal conditions of faith or belief is when it's based on knowledge. Intro. Can you sort of elaborate on that whole line of thought?
Well, I'll try. One of the things that we need to think about is precisely what is faith and how does it relate to knowledge, and then we have to say what knowledge is. We got into that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is, understand that faith and belief are the same things.
Okay.
You have faith in things that you believe. You believe what you have faith in. And so faith is a readiness to act as if something were true.
Okay.
That's the basic idea of faith. And it helps to say that you always live up to your beliefs. There are some tensions there because our beliefs are often contradictory, but in general, you do what you believe. It's important to say that because in our culture, we tend to equate faith with a profession of faith. Now, you don't live up to what you profess to believe unless you believe it. And we have placed a premium in religious circles and in political circles on professing to believe things that we don't necessarily believe, because professing to believe ties into social conformity and acceptance. But belief is where you really do, you really are set to act as if something were true. I often illustrate this in speaking by just pointing out how people are sitting in their chairs. They believe the chairs will hold them up. If they didn't believe that, they wouldn't be sitting in the chair, or they wouldn't be sitting there that way. So that's the nature of belief. A person, for example, who believes that there is no God acts as if there were none, regardless of what they may or may not profess.
So what about this aspect? What about where you write that the ideal conditions of faith or belief is when it is based
right.
on knowledge?
Right. That's what we want people to do. We want them to believe things that they know, and that is the normal situation. Right. Now, I know where my parking garage at USC is, and I act on that belief. If I have believed it but didn't know it, then not only I, but probably a lot of other people would soon be in trouble around the place. Because believing without knowing tends to run you into realities that you're unprepared for. Because belief does not require truth. And it does not require good evidence. Belief comes from all sorts of places. Little children pick up their beliefs from their surroundings. Watching sports, people come to believe things because they are able to work themselves up into thinking that the Houston Rockets will beat the Lakers. It's possible that what they believe is true, but they don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the people who think the Lakers will win don't know it. They believe it. But see, that's the nature of belief. Belief outruns knowledge on the one hand, and it's a good thing because there are a lot of things we need to believe in order to act that we don't know and can't know in some cases. But the fact of the matter is we want our garage mechanic, for example, our automobile mechanic, to believe what they know. And we want them to have knowledge to base their beliefs on. And we want our dentist. And it would be nice if our politicians knew what they believe.
Yes. Everyone's feeling that fairly strongly right now.
Yes, indeed. And I use the illustration, you may recall, of gambling. See,
mm-hmm.
that's a case where people typically believe what they do not know.
Yeah.
And that's really a paradigm of life. Like our group of people that were covered in the study that you're referencing from the report in the Atlantic Monthly, those are people who believe a lot of stuff that they don't know.
I'd like to get back to that study, Dallas. If you're just joining us now, we were talking at the top of the show about the Grant study referenced this week in both the New York Times and the Atlantic Monthly, where let's see, 268 promising young men from Harvard were studied over the course of their lives to find out who's well off. What does it take to be successful? How can you live the good life? And how can you be good? And not coming to very strong conclusions other than it's found in relationships. I thought it was so interesting, Dallas, that even in the outlook of that study, the goal of the study, they didn't phrase it quite like you did, like, what is it take to be good and to live a good
mm-hmm.
life. They phrased it in terms of success and
right.
happiness. And it does
right.
seem like in America we're more concerned about happiness than good than goodness.
Yep.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's partly because we think we can be successful without being good. And that's a very profound belief on the parts of most people. And that's how our universities work. They promise people success. And they have some moral presuppositions that they're not examining usually. They're very obvious if you're on the grounds. But still, they think that you don't have to teach people how to be good in order to teach them how to be successful.
Yeah. And so you've written in your book, Knowing Christ Today, Why We Can Trust Spiritual Knowledge.
Right.
You've written about how we decide what's good in today's world, both as individuals and as communities. So as a community, just in a nut, because I don't want to get really involved in an answer here, but just in a nut, as a community, how do we say what's good?
Well, if you have genuine community, then you can focus on what the study mentions, that is relationships, and ask yourself, how in community do you make relationships good and have healthy people?
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, that's something that's been studied for millennia because it's such a vital human question. So what we do is, to switch to very concrete terminology, we make intelligent inquiry and study into how to love people and care for people, and teach people how to do that from the elementary grades up. And we don't mess around with it. We teach people that, for example, you don't ridicule others. You don't have contempt for others. If you injure someone, you help them. And you don't put yourself above everyone else. So basically what you had to do is give solid moral teaching. See, when that study talks about how important relationships are, they're using that in a normative sense. They mean good relationships. They don't just mean relationships. A guy who is mugging someone on the street has a relationship to them. It's not a good relationship. So you can't just say relationship, and they don't say that. They really mean how important good relationships are to well-being.
Yeah, I was struck in your book how, in the broader sense, as far as boots on the ground and how it actually works in our larger community of here in America, you know, because because the whole discussion of goodness is so excluded from the public square, that we just wind up relying on the Supreme Court to finally settle the idea of who is good and what is good.
That isn't, yes, that is, now that is the condition in the land.
Yes.
Since educational institutions have abandoned this idea of what is good and who is good, then people turn to law and politics to settle issues. Up until very recently, no one thought that the Supreme Court was a moral arbiter. Now they do.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why it has had such increasing power, is because people's assumptions are that it settles moral issues.
Well, Dallas, it does seem, I really resonated with another aspect of how you describe the condition of goodness in our country. You talked about how when it comes to the individual trying to determine goodness, we have this focus on do I follow some goal or picture of goodness, or do I follow my desires for what I want to do and be?
Mm-hmm.
And you say that quite often, you know, our approach to the life well lived and success and happiness is following my desires without much thought for goodness, you know, to almost elevate desire over the question of goodness. Am I understanding you right?
Right, or just replacing it with the assumption that if you desire something, it's good. Well, you only have to think a few moments about that to realize that your own desires are inconsistent, and that if you try to follow them, you're going to sacrifice goodness to them and wind up simply pursuing what you want. And in our country today, people are so confused about desire and love. Love is oriented towards goodness, that they confuse them. They think they're the same thing.
Yeah.
And again, here's where you just have to be thoughtful and you will begin to get clear. But there has been no civilization on earth that has equated desire and goodness. They all know that you have to watch desire. Desire is dangerous. But in our culture, we emphasize freedom as such a fundamental value.
Uh-huh.
And think by that people mean doing what you want. And at each point, there are just levels of confusion that you have to work through.
Okay, that's a great place to maybe take a little bit of a break. And when we come back from the break, let's probe that a little bit further to talk about this daily ultimate choice between desire and goodness. And and do we really, is really that the only choice before us? We have to deny our desires or else go for goodness. And when we come back, we'll talk about that. This is Leah Larrington.
And Rick Davis.
On the Things That Matter Most, talking with Dallas Willard. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off because we have three ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes. So without any effort,
you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. Three ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening. Main Street Crossing, a live entertainment venue in Tomball, is home to a very unusual assortment of groups and activities. One of these is a Christian gathering we call Sundays, S-O-N-D-A-Y-S. At Sundays, we try to live out Christian life together 7 days a week using Main Street Crossing as home base. Any and every time of the week, Sunday's friends can be found sipping coffee, eating lunch, or sipping a beer or wine at Main Street Crossing, never knowing which friend will come in the door to join in. And yes, there is a short church service for Sundays, on Sunday, evenings at 7 o'clock. But to us, the Sunday service is a very small part of our 7-day-a-week friendship. Whether you're personally at the end of your rope or feeling like you'd like to help those who are, you're welcome at Sundays at Main Street Crossing. Stop by Main Street Crossing and see what's up with Sundays. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we bring you guests and discussions to help you decide what you think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life.
And we're talking with Dallas Willard about his book about how we know, how we can know things, and what should the university teach, and what does it teach about being a success or being happy or being good, especially. And the subtitle of his book is Why We Can Trust Spiritual Knowledge That Gives Us True Knowledge About These Things. And Dallas, I would say that many people like me maybe grew up in a church and absorbed the idea that the goal of life was to be good, to obey God, and that in order to seek to be good, though, I had to deny my desires. I had to sacrifice my own pleasure and joy in order to achieve that goal. Do you think that that's the way life is, that the daily choice and the ultimate choice is always between our desire on the one hand and goodness on the other hand? Our desire for pleasure and joy and goodness and obedience and sacrifice, and denying our desire for pleasure and joy on the one hand, or this desire for goodness and obedience and sacrifice and denying desire on the other hand. Does that explain it? Is that the choice?
Well, you have to be careful and say what these terms mean and how they relate to one another. Mm-hmm. Basically, what is good is what you would choose if you had a perfect understanding of its outcome. I mean, that sounds a little hard to get, but tradition actually, and earlier we talked about moms and dads,
yeah.
They have a lot of wisdom on this point. And so they have good has a long view, a comparative view of ends we might pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Desire does not. Desire simply, as the song says, I want what I want when I want it. And you see desire at work in a child who simply wants something. And mom and dad say, now you don't want that. And oh, yes, they do. But see, they don't consider alternatives, and they don't consider the long run. And so they wind up confusing desire and good. And now that childish attitude has become the dominant approach to life in our culture. That's why, for example, we have such a problem with addiction. See, the addict is a person who has signed over his will to his desires. And he or she often, usually, comes to a point where they say, I've just got to have a drink or a donut or a fix or something of that sort. And I've just got to have it. But the answer is, yeah. No, you don't have to have it. You have a will, and your will is designed to choose what is good and not simply to be the victim of what you desire. But see, people, even linguistic usage is confused. For example, people say things like, oh, I love chocolate cake. They don't love chocolate cake. They want to eat it. That's different.
You know,
if you're a chocolate cake and you hear someone saying, I love chocolate cake, you know what to expect next.
Yeah.
And being good and being desired are two different things. Now, if you're raised in our culture, you have no place to stand to resist things like desire for a fix or a hit or a buzz from alcohol or all that, and you wind up enslaved to it. So that's where good comes in over against desire. If you educate people in terms of what is good, which used to be done from the earliest grades by the little textbooks that people used in elementary school, no longer is that true.
Yeah. You know, I thought you were going to go for a definition on two other words in that comparison. You know, is it the good or is it desire? I thought you might tackle the difference between pleasure and joy. Because I think one
that comes in now.
Yeah,
because
I think
pleasure is normally attached to desire.
Right.
And again, pleasure is localized, it's specific, it's this very thing here, whether it's sex or food or whatever, that's what you want. Joy is a pervasive sense of well-being. You have joy in life. If you have pleasure in life, you're in trouble. But joy goes with love and will by making the broader scene dominant in our life. Now, the problem for ethics, ever since there's been one, has been how to have a place to stand, to do what you don't want to do, and to not do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Desire is the problem of ethics. How to handle it. Just going to say, add this one point, that in the Western world, which is dominated by a Christian outlook on these matters of desire and good, we don't hold that desire is bad. See, that goes with certain Eastern religions,
Stoicism.
Yeah, they say asceticism comes down in Christian form that way. But the rule in the biblical and classical point of view is subordination of desire to good, and then desire is fine.
Yeah.
And you right, Plato builds his whole ethical theory around that. You subordinate desire to what is good.
You know, one thing that was very clarifying for me was just to sort out the difference between joy and pleasure. Because I realized that the goal of life, as God intended it, is joy. It's not duty to do the good as much as you do your duty to do the good in order that the ultimate result is joy and life to the full. And so I came to really understand that the denial of my desire for pleasure was really the key to my ultimate joy and the ultimate experience of life, so that my joy or my ultimate pleasure and being good, even sacrificing my desires to be good, are ultimately one and the same. I love the way John Piper calls that Christian hedonism. It's like you're going for joy.
Yes.
You are going for joy. But the way through it is to submit your desires to your will, as you've said, and to seek the good in the life, knowing that the ultimate product is joy, and that is so much more, it's maybe what a lot of the people in that study didn't have.
Well, and Lael, you're pointing to the, you know, the misunderstanding out there of people that don't have spiritual truth, the misunderstanding that you and I, let's say, we're known as Christians, that really what we're living is the denial of joy. In other words,
right,
we're giving everything up, and why would we do that? And the fact of the matter
is, all duty.
To use Piper's phrase, it's really a more enlightened self-interest. It is a Christian hedonism.
Yeah.
And so that's why Jesus says, my burden is easy, or my yoke is easy, my burden is light, I've come to bring you life to the full. It's an incredible way to live. But there's a big misunderstanding out there, correct, Alice? Do you agree with that?
Oh, yes, and it's very difficult to straighten it out. And you have to be very careful about the way you set up the motivation there, because you don't really aim for joy. You aim for what is good with the knowledge that joy will be there. You can become a joy addict, and what you want to be is a good addict, a God addict, from the Christian point of view. And so you want to be clear that we're not in it for the joy. We're in it for the good. And we know that joy comes that way. Now, that distinction, again, is as old as Aristotle, at least. But it's important to keep it in mind, because the good itself is not joy, but you can always be sure that joy will be there, so you don't have to worry about it. Mm. It'll take care of itself.
Yeah.
You focus on what is good. As old Immanuel Kant used to say, you don't try to be happy, you try to be worthy of happiness, and it will come.
Yes. I mean, that setting your sights on joy is such an elusive thing, because it's the fruit of other things.
That's a very solid point. I mean, the thing is, if you just set your sights on joy, you don't really know how to get that. So you set your sights on good, on God, on what is good for others, on loving relationships, and lo and behold, you find joy. It's like the old story of Acres of Diamonds, Russell Connell's old story about how the man in South Africa left to look for diamonds all over the world, and they were in his backyard.
Wow.
It's a great old story, Acres of Diamonds.
Yeah. I would like to ask our audience, Dallas, a question that you posed in your book, Knowing Christ Today, this new book on how we can trust spiritual knowledge. And I would just like to ask you out there, maybe you're driving your car, maybe you've downloaded the show from our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, you're listening on your iPod, or who knows where you are as you're listening to this, but we're thinking about you right now, and we're saying, what comes to mind who comes to mind when we say the words knowledgeable, brilliant, or smart? And if I, you know, could see you now, I hope that you would just be mouthing the word. Who is it? And Dallas, you wrote about this in The Divine Conspiracy. You wrote, most people will think of someone like Einstein's or Bill Gates or the obligatory rocket science. And in our culture, Jesus Christ is automatically disassociated from brilliance or intellectual capacity. Why is that?
Yes, in this book, I use the line, they see Christ as an airhead standing helplessly before PhDs.
Yes.
But actually, Jesus would run well in the race, to put it mildly, and when you consider his answers to these basic questions that we're talking about and put them to the test, it's pretty clear he was the most knowledgeable person who has hit the earth, and whatever advantages he may have worked out well for the human beings who listened to him.
Yeah. I love the way you put it when you said, Jesus is not just nice. He's brilliant. He's the smartest man who ever lived. He always has the best information on everything, and certainly also on the things that matter most in human life.
Yes, indeed. And again, if you want to know that, you just put him flat-footed in contrast with everyone else who's addressing the questions.
Well, and how so? Why would you grant, I mean, you've sort of answered my question, which was, why would you grant Jesus that credibility to offer knowledge? Give us an example.
Well, for example, take Freud. Now, Freud, for several decades, maybe a century, was thought to be a profoundly brilliant man dealing with human life. Well, just try to live by Freud and see what happens. Actually, no one would do that now. Or Nietzsche, another one. He's thought to be very good. Well, just put his statements to the test alongside the statements of Jesus about what is real, who is well off, who's a really good person, how do you get to be a good person. And there is no even beginning of a competition.
Hmm.
See, what happens is, among human beings who are fundamentally on, they want to do what they want. I mean, it isn't just American culture. We have lifted doing what we want up to an ultimate goal. But it's true of every human being, they want to. It's just most human beings live in conditions where they can't even start to think about doing that unless they happen to be the top person on the pile. And then, of course, we see the awful things that happen in that case, but you just simply have to put Jesus down here and say, well, what's the question about reality and so on?
Yeah.
Compare them to all of the others, and you see that this, and for the moment, let's say this man, Jesus, was way out ahead of the pack.
If you could describe the relationship between knowledge and power, and then as a source of knowledge about human flourishing, how would you measure the power, the impact that Jesus has had?
Well, you always measure power or energy by the work done. Work and energy or power correlate. And so you have to look at the actual effects of Jesus on human history. And that is not an easy thing, because at this point, in order to see Jesus clearly, you're going to have to get past a good deal of what came to be known as Christendom. And that's one reason why many of the recent attacks on religion have focused on Christendom,
right,
not on Jesus. And so you have to look at the actual effects of Jesus on human life. And you might think the thought that it is not an accident that just in terms of numbers, Christianity is the largest religion on the face of the earth. But that can be misleading because there's so many other factors mixed in. You have to work through those and go to the heart of the teaching to see why that is true. And I think it is true because when you consider it fairly and thoroughly, you see that the effect of Jesus for good, both in terms of well-being and the kind of people you get out of it, he was far superior to any other person who has addressed the issues.
We have about 1 minute left in the segment, Dallas. How have you most clearly seen this power in your own life?
First and primary answer to that is to the directions that I have taken by choice and have been given by Providence, and how they have turned out. And one has to be careful here, because on that point, it is better for other people to make the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say that I have had a wonderful experiential life of the goodness and the power that is present as a follower of Christ. Now then, beyond that, looking at other people's lives, once again, you can see that the people who put into practice beliefs based on the knowledge of Christ that comes down to anyone who's willing to see it, I think you see immediately both that the power to live a good life and to be a good person comes with spiritual knowledge of Christ. And again, now that all of these statements that we make like this have to be out there for others to judge and to fairly examine. And all one can ask is, an old philosopher that I liked a lot from the 19th century named L.T. Hobhouse used to say that all religion requires of philosophy is a fair field and no quarter given, which is an old-fashioned way of referring to battles and combat. And
right.
They just go full tilt.
Yeah.
And
well,
that's all that's required.
That is, it's so engaging, and the book is so good that we've decided to have Dallas back next week to continue the discussion. And so we'll wrap this up. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week for a little bit more about how we can trust, how we can know things about the questions that really matter. Who's well off? How do we be good? And how we can trust spiritual knowledge in that category. So this is Leah Larrington.
And Rick Davis.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. We're always interested in making our show better, and you, our listeners, can play a role. We'd like your feedback on what you like about our show and what you think can be better. You can give us your insights by going to thethingsthatmattermost.org or by sending us an email at info@thethingsthatmattermost.org. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
How many Texans go hungry? In one of the wealthiest, most agriculturally rich states in the nation, over 3.1 million people in Texas don't always know where they will get groceries or money for their next meal.
I'm Alonzo Highsmith, spokesperson for the new Kid Care. The faces of hunger vary. Many of these people are children or the elderly. They may be Caucasian, African American, Hispanic, or Asian. Now that you know who these people are, here's how you can help.
Here in Houston, the new Kid Care provides lunches to more than 900 children every day. Our emergency food pantry is available for people to visit. As the new Kid Care grows, so does our clothing bank.
Please consider helping us build this program with your financial support. You can do that by going online at thenewkidcare.com or by calling 713-695-5437.
The new Kid Care. It's working here in Houston.
Okay, we're back on the things that matter most. Just wrapping up an interview with Dallas Willard. Lael, what are your comments?
Well, one of the biggest things that hits me, Rick, is this importance of knowing Christ as a person. And I loved it how Willard, in his book, Knowing Christ Today, talked about how we know Christ in others. And he says, reflect on what goes on within you when you first see another person. It may be a member of your family or a friend. Is your first thought that they should be blessed by God in every way? Are you trying to see them as God sees them? Are you trying to connect the love of God to that person? Are you seeing them as better than you? Are you approaching them in humility? Are you prepared to serve them by lifting them up to God in prayer for His utmost gifts to them, by assisting them in their needs? Do you earnestly long that their light should shine in such a way, especially if they're Christians, that others would see their good works and glorify God? You know, just the basics of what the Bible teaches about goodness and goodness in relationships and what it takes to walk into the room in the presence of another person and desire their good in our interface with them. And it's just, you know, it's so easy to toss around the idea, well, yeah, I'm a good person. I love everybody. And then I'm confronted with questions like this that just challenge me to the core. And I think how much I have to learn about goodness and about knowing Christ and about knowing Christ in other people. The book has been a very profound challenge on just so many levels.
Yeah, what you're talking about there, Lael, what goes on inside of us when we first see other people. What that reveals about what we really believe and how much we are really seeing life and other people the way God does.
Right. And how much we're really living according to the knowledge that we have of what we believe to be good and true.
Yes.
How is it acting? How are we acting it out? And it shows how much we believe it. How much we have this knowledge, but how much we believe it, how much is our will inclined to act on that knowledge?
Well, and really, Lael, what you're pointing out there is that I think you're speaking in the first person a little bit here.
Absolutely.
It just shows us, I mean, you're way down the path, this Jesus path, and here you are saying, wow, you know, I have so much to learn, which I think is a great place for us to be.
And so we come in that humility to the cross of Jesus and say,
yes,
yeah, forgive me and I need you.
Yes, exactly. Okay. All right, wraps up another show. We're getting ready to go into another very busy week. We all have lots of things to keep us entirely occupied, but it's the kinds of questions that we talk about on this show that in the end are going to be the most important. So let's not get so busy this week that we don't take time to think about the things that matter most.